That's right, we're back, ladies and gentlemen, for another episode of Political Football. It's been a while between drinks, both figuratively and literally, and I'm joined here by my long-running co-host, Mr. Joe Boyden. How are you? We played a bit of Funky Town there, obviously to celebrate the end of lockdown as we have known it. How are you feeling, mate, and what are we looking forward to?
I've never felt funkier, if I'm going to be honest. You know, 4 months or so locked inside, I'm feeling pretty funky. It's good to be back. I'm feeling refreshed. Good to get some fresh air finally, and I'm back in Cinque Docca.
Yeah, Cinque Docca, and I got to say, I went down to the shops a little earlier, and it was buzzing. We're talking lines outside of the barber shop there, Empire Barber Store. You know, all your local Italians and Lebanese down there, having a haircut, getting that fresh fade for the boys.
I did forget what traffic was like though.
Yes,
and I was nearly running late here, left with plenty of time to spare, and sitting in traffic, I thought, what's this?
Yeah, I saw, you know, when I went for a walk earlier this morning, I said, geez, what's a car? And anyway, yeah, that's part and parcel of getting out of lockdown, you know, a bit of foot traffic, actual traffic, car traffic, that is. You know, good to see some businesses opening back up again. Mm. And I must say, just before we get the podcast going, we're speaking about this off air, is just the Australian public's rallying around the vaccine. I mean, you hear often those with the loudest voice, you hear them the most in the media, and you know that's what generates clicks and things like that. But when it came to rolling up their sleeve and not only protecting yourself, but protecting those around, the Australian public have yet again shown we have great strength in our institutions, you know, and we're on track for certainly New South Wales. ACT, it's going to be on the most, obviously, your homeland is, it's going to be the most vaccinated jurisdiction in the world. They're at 98% first dose.
Really?
For 16 and above. So by the end of the month, I think for 12 and above, they'll have everyone over 95%. So, yeah, that is sensational stuff. And take your hats off to them. And again, you know, there's only a few numpties here.
It was good. They did a great job. But one thing I didn't understand was when I was at Kudos Bank Arena, you know, you're sitting in the middle of the floor like I was, you know, NBL champion. And they've got the advertising sort of video pictures playing above you when you're in, you know, like you get your jab and you have to sit down for 15 minutes. And you got to play it in front of you. I'm like, why are you advertising us now? I've already got my jab.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like,
how about at least show me the footy, NBA
like,
or something.
The NFL's on. Like, give me something here. I'm sitting here watching ads. I've already just gone and done what you want me to do. But anyway,
we'll make a recommendation to the commissioner on that one.
I reckon I can sort him out.
Yeah. But let's talk about what we're here for today, and that's to talk a little bit of footy a bit later on. Obviously, grand final review and a season review for all 16 clubs. But in the interim, we'll be talking a bit about public trust and integrity, an issue close to my heart. Something I've studied a bit. I'm a postgraduate coursework at the University of Sydney, but we're aptly named this episode, Say Hello to My Little Friend. Obviously, that famous Scarface reference. And if you don't get the inference there, obviously, we're drawing that Scarface reference, but it's in reference to the Gladys Berejiklian ICAC fallout. In October last year, she appeared as a witness in the investigation of Darryl Maguire and his issuing of corrupt dealings as an MP for Wagga Wagga, in which he referred to some of the land deals, which were clearly not above board, as to my little friend when he was on the phone to her. So just a little intertextual reference. I know it's quite niche, but just to appreciate this sort of the ability that I have to put one and two together. But just to give a bit more fact on the issue, on Friday, October 1, 2021, a media release from the Independent Commission Against Corruption confirmed it was investigating whether between 2012 and 2018, the Honourable Gladys Berejiklian MP engaged in conduct that constituted or involved a breach of public trust by exercising public functions in circumstances where she was in a position of conflict between herself and her public duties, involved partial exercise of any of her official functions in relation to two grants, one to the Australian Clay Target Association in 2016-17, and one to the Riverina Conservatorium of Music in Wagga Wagga, both features, both attractions that were within Daryl Maguire's electorate. Or in third point was dishonest in her exercising of official functions in breaching public trust as part of Section 11 and disclosure in the Independent Commission Against Corruptions Act 1988. So that's the core of the matter, right? I feel like it, there's been a lot of commentary around, or, you know, was it the right time for her to go or whatever? But this is what the investigation is into. So I think it's important that we establish that as a base fact as to what they're doing. And also to note that prior to the announcement of this investigation, they would have conducted a private investigation. In relation to the ICAC model, that's how it works, right? They don't come out and announce these things willy-nilly. They do background work and they don't ask any questions they don't know the answer to. So what would have happened was last year, the investigation of Daryl Maguire revealed matters in relation to Gladys Berejiklian's integrity and potential breaching of public trust. And then they would have gone away in this period between last October last year and now and investigated this and made sure there wasn't any loose ends. And they announced it because they determined that the private investigation warranted a public hearing, which starts next week. So That's the process of how it's come about. And then later that afternoon, Gladys resigned. Now, a lot of people obviously giving their thoughts on this, talking about Gladys, you know, being a person of integrity, which I just find a bit questioning, seeing she is under investigation for that very matter. But what was your initial reaction when you heard this fallout?
Well, obviously, I don't really know the ins and outs like yourself, yeah. Paulie, but I don't know. It kind of just annoyed me a little bit at the time because, you know, a lot of the stuff I saw, because I don't dig too far into it, and I was, you know, obviously a lot of other things going on in life, so I was focused on a few other things. But a lot of people were vilifying her while she was the Premier, and yeah. Then she loses her job, and then all you hear is people feeling sorry for her, saying she's being done hard by, you know what I mean? So I just don't, like, the way, you know, people just want something to get up in arms about, and that's the way I looked up at it. But I'm learning more than our bloody listeners will be right now by what you're saying, so give me some more.
So I think that's a good point that you mentioned there, and perhaps we can dig a little bit more into that, into the analysis. But the next part where I was going to go was some of the extracts from Gladys's statement and just picking these apart as to why perhaps they were a bit of an exaggeration of the truth. The first one she said is, "My resignation as Premier could not happen at a worse time, but the timing is completely outside of my control as the ICAC has chosen to take this action during the most challenging weeks of the most challenging time in the history of New South Wales." Now, I don't want to sound like I'm engaging a bit of hyperbole myself, but my initial reaction to that, well, that is ridiculous.
But is it though? Because, like, if they have an investigation on her, could have, like, the decision come earlier where she could have left the job earlier, or what would the harm be? Like, if she had committed any form of corruption all those years ago, what would the further harm be by trying to let her see out the next couple months as Premier? I mean, I'm not sticking up for her. This just runs
through my head. A valid question. A lot of people ask this, and the reason they did it now is because if they wait, ICAC doesn't take into consideration political ramifications, right? Their whole representation is to maintain public trust and integrity. So the whole thing is that you shouldn't wait for timing, right? If they waited for timing, their own independence would come into question because, oh, we thought it wouldn't be a bad time. But when is a good time to deal with corruption and public trust, right? So they've obviously got to a point where they've been satisfied and it's gone through. They have internal rigors, you know, QA and everything that goes by in terms of accountability internally. They even have, there's an ICAC commissioner that even looks at, you know, make sure ICAC itself is integrity based. So when people say ICAC has no master, well, it actually does. They have a panel that determines their accountability and their integrity as well to make sure they're not engaging in anything that would be contrary to what they're trying to implement in terms of public trust and to educate the public on corruption matters. So I just found that a bit ridiculous. Also, in the sense that she stopped the daily press conferences about a month ago. Now, there was questioning at the time whether it was because of this. So, you know, obviously, those in the media who investigated this, I think Paul Farrell, I think his name is from ABC 730, asked at the time, and he got caught blown out of the water at one of the press conferences. Can you please respect the press conference? The old classic, it's a classic teacher one. Respect the press conference. You know, I think that was to try and you know, I can understand why she tried to do that. She's tried to deflect away from the matter, and that, you know, that's fine. But I have the right to call it out, and I think that was, as Stephen A. Smith would say, bogus. And then she also went on to say that this is ICAC's prerogative. Resigning at this time is against every instinct in my being and something which I do not want to do. I love my job and serving the community, but I have given no option. I have been given no option but to issue the following statement instead, which is obviously she's referring to a resignation there. But again, this is ICAC prerogative. Like, they actively wanted her, you know, to resign now. Again, that's not into consideration at all, because they're independent. They don't take into consideration that. All they do is talk about public trust and corruption. So that was, again, blame shifting at its finest.
But I guess on the other side of it is, though, I guess if you're... I'm assuming she's, like, standing by that she's obviously innocent, right? I'm assuming that's her stance, because if she wasn't, she would have left the job before, right?
Yeah.
So I guess the only thing I can see, like, in that sort of, like, she's saying if she kind of knows she's innocent, or if she believes wholeheartedly she's innocent, she's pissed off. And that's why she's saying this is their prerogative. They don't, because, you know what I mean? If she gets cleared and it's all good and she didn't do anything wrong, she's gone then and lost the job as Premier of New South Wales, which could possibly be the pinnacle of her career.
Yeah.
And she's lost something over an investigation where she knew she was not in the wrong. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I guess it looks more like finger pointing and childish kind of blame. But I mean, you kind of got to, you know what I mean? You kind of
And that's
I can empathise with that a little bit.
You know? And I know you see how many keeping across with the issue, but that's been, it hits on a point that a lot of people have been coming in support of Gladys have been saying. But there is precedent to say that she didn't have to necessarily resign from her position, or indeed as she's going to resign from New South Wales Parliament. There is precedent to this. In 1983, Labor Premier Neville Rann stood aside for 74 days and allowed his Deputy Premier Jack Ferguson to serve as Acting Premier. At the time, Mr. Rann was facing allegations made by ABC's Four Corners that he tried to influence a magistrate to have a charge of misappropriating funds against New South Wales rugby league boss Kevin Humphries dismissed.
No.
Fun fact about Kevin Humphries, he used to live in the apartment down here where my grandmother used to live, and used to say, "Hello, Kevin." Obviously, he didn't know about his dealings in the nefarious dealings in the 80s and 90s, sure, but he was always nice to me as a little kid. That's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I mean, and I would have said that next. I was going to say, like, could they have stepped aside? So that's where it comes next. So you've kind of wrapped that up for me.
Yeah. So she could definitely step aside, but then people say, well, that's untenable because you don't know how long the investigation could go on. And obviously, these factors are a part of it. And I'm not saying the New South Wales ICAC model can't improve, but a strong and robust independent commission against corruption or anti-corruption agency needs to have robust powers. And I think that's what we're trying to get at here is in relation to ICAC's charter. They have three key functions of their act. Number one is to investigate and expose corruption in the New South Wales public sector. I think they've been pretty successful at that to date, both sides of parliament, right? So they say power corrupts. Number two, to actively prevent corruption through advice and assistance. So not only exposing corruption, but minimising it actually happening in the first place, which obviously I think is important. And then number three is to educate the New South Wales community and public sector about corruption and its effects. Now, given some of the fallout of this and some of the misguided commentary around it, I think we need to have a better discussion around what corruption is and just how much of a cost it comes at to the community as a whole. Now, I've gone and studied it in a postgraduate coursework at university through my public policy degree, but how much do you actually learn about corruption at school? I can't remember a history course. I can't remember any sort of, even English work. You might touch on it here and there, but there is no serious framework at school or in any sort of form of education, I think, where it's talked about or actively engaged with. And I think that comes back to an issue as to how this was talked about. ICAC is not a court.
unless it was a product of your own research in school, you wouldn't learn about it if it was about an Australian case, you know what I mean? Like, when you look at something like the Soviet Union or something like that, you'd possibly go into it, but I don't think one of the main study points would be corruption in school. So, yeah, you're right there.
And, you know, so the jurisdiction of ICAC extends to all public sector agencies, and I just think that when we're talking about corruption, we need to understand the cost that it comes at. If we don't have public trust... If we don't have, we don't trust the people making the decisions with taxpayer dollars, so to speak. And I hate using the term taxpayer dollar because it feels like I'm on an episode of A Current Affair. But for the search of a better term, that's what I'll use for the time being. If we don't have a better way of, if we don't trust the people with the public funds, how on earth can we have meaningful discussions about what those public funds go towards? You know, and that has been at the precipice of Australian democracy, is that we have faith in our institutions. I talked on a bit earlier in terms of our institutions in relation to the vaccine and, you know, New South Wales Health and the Department of Health. You know, all these departments do a great job of, you know, and the average person still has great faith in them. But this doesn't mean that we can take this for granted. We have to continually work on it. And by shining a light in dark places, often where lights don't want to be shone, then, you know, that this is a necessary process, because, like I said, if we don't have that, how on earth can we have discussions about funding for schools? How on earth can we have discussions about, you know, taxation reform, any policy issue? Because we don't arrive at, we don't tick the first box, which is that we must have people who are unimpeachable, so to speak, and that hold the public office to a higher standard. So as I said here in my notes, I think it's clear that some on Macquarie Street and members of the mainstream media need a refresh in their education about public sector ethics and corruption, given their sycophantic coverage of Gladys's resignation as Premier. And also, I just think that some of the opinion has been bedeviled by an inner city narrative, you know, like in relations to... If you went to Western and Southwestern Sydney, which have received vastly different treatment in the outbreak of this COVID wave compared to the initial outbreak in Sydney's eastern suburbs, I think there would be a slightly different approach, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that people who live, you know, in these other areas, their opinion is invalid. Of course it is. I'm just saying that outside the halls of power in media and political spheres, that, you know, I was reading in the Sydney Morning Herald on the weekend, there was two sort of narratives. People, because it comes in with their name and the suburb they're in, you know, and sort of the inner city suburbs are saying, oh, I understand ICAC, you know, had to do what it had to do, but it was an unfortunate timing. Whereas people in southwestern Sydney, we've had curfews, we've had, you know, extra mask mandates and that sort of thing, and we've sort of had a two-tier response to the pandemic. As George Horrell, one of the residents, who I don't mind, I hope he doesn't mind me quoting him. Haven't checked with him, but he wrote in the paper, so I presume it's okay. Her coup de grace was to relegate Canterbury-Bankstown residents to second-class status during the lockdown. So obviously Canterbury-Bankstown was one of the hardest hit areas when the wave exploded. And I think... you know, that's an important perspective that I wanted to bring to the table today, because we live in a democracy and I think everyone's voice is as important as another. And I just think, you know, that the coverage has been a bit how you're going. So that's a part of the reason we covered that. As I mentioned, just covering off here, the fact of the matter is the heart of democracy is the ability for public sector ethics and corruption, because without that, we don't have social trust and social harmony. And they are undermined to the extent that the whole nature of government is undermined.
Can I just come back to?
Sure.
I'm just thinking about it. In terms of education on corruption, where do you think the responsibility lies there? Because obviously, not every industry necessarily you can be corrupt. Essentially, so when you talk about educating about corruption, you're also running the risk of teaching people how to dodge corruption, right? Because that's all. Yeah. People are always going to think two sides of something you're learning. Yeah. So if you're talking about exposing corruption and teaching people how to notice it, you will then also teach people how to dodge it. So would a bigger focus on educating of corruption bring the potential for more corruption? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know what you mean.
Because yeah. I guess the thing, you can't have ignorance and you can't ignore it. And yes, we need to teach more people the risks of it and stuff. But at the same time, you could be giving the people the keys to do it better.
Yeah. And I think that comes back to having sort of a more sort of holistic approach to how we deal with corruption. For example, obviously a lot of it deals with public funds, or you have infinite incidences of collusion and other matters in the private sector. The thing is we need to have simpler rules, so it's easy to understand. So there isn't all so many loopholes for people to exploit in the first place, whether it comes to the tax system, whether it comes to how payments are transferred and processes. So that probably goes to a whole government response. But I feel there's always going to be people that try and manipulate the system to their own accord, but it doesn't mean that you don't have more robust practices in place and more people being educated about what corruption is and being able to identify it, as opposed to seeing something, it looks a bit off, but I'm not sure what to do about it. Mm. I think we'll ultimately have more positive outcomes. But that's a good point that you raise.
I feel like if you just focus was more on teaching people how to identify the kind of characteristics of someone tempted to be corrupt. You know what I mean? Because there'd be different motivations to be corrupt. It's either to put more money in your pocket because you're struggling, or it's because you have some sort of sociopathic need to be better than other people. And I feel like if you taught people how to notice and recognize those warning signs earlier, they might be able to help themselves before they hurt other people.
I think that comes back to the preventative aspect of it, isn't it, as well? And
an early age. Yeah. So I guess that's something you'd bring in school through, business classes in schools or whatever.
For sure.
Or learning about things that actually happen in our governments rather than focusing on broader international stuff at times. But, that's a conversation for another day.
Yep, and just to finish up on this point of corruption, another aspect of this debate has it shone a light on we don't have a federal anti-corruption agency, and it's become a big issue. It's been over 1,000 days since Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister, and then Attorney General Christian Porter promised a federal ICAC in some form or another, and there has been some model put forward, but we still haven't seen any legislation brought before the House of Representatives. And forgive me for being the cynic in me, but it's the only jurisdiction in Australia, state or federal, so every state government has some form of an anti-corruption agency. Some are stronger than others. New South Wales ICAC model is particularly strong. Victoria's one's quite robust as well, and they have the ability to have public hearings, which I think is obviously very important. They have their ability to launch their own investigations, which is obviously very important. They have the ability to have anonymous tips, so if a tip comes in, they can investigate it to follow it through. But the federal ICAC model is different to this. It's watered down effectively. The Centre for Public Integrity have come out and said you may as well not have one if you brought the one they currently wanted to bring in, which would have created a two-tier system. So it would almost have New South Wales like powers for the police and the justice system, so it could investigate police and other sort of officials in public enforcement.
Do the higher up officials at ICAC, do they come from a political background?
I'm not sure what the process is of recruitment. I would say they probably come from a judicial background.
Because they'd have to be, that would be something that goes into it, right?
They have solicitors. The solicitors, obviously, the ones, because they're prosecuting the case and they have the investigators. Yeah, I'm not inside the walls of
life. Everyone has friends and everyone has a history and a background. Yeah, well, the last thing you'd want is the corruption agency being corrupt.
Yeah, that's the whole point. And that's why I said they have an individual panel that probably evaluates their staff, and there's probably a robust panel. Like, for example, you probably couldn't be a member of a political party. There'd have to be maybe a period of time before you start your job there that you aren't a member. You'd have to, they'd probably declare your financials. I mean, you think that all these things would be in place.
You'd have to think so.
Yeah. And seeing that no one's made any accusations against the people in ICAC, then...
You wait till I rock up on their doorstep, mate. I'll be swinging.
But if we just talk about the federal ICAC for an important moment, is it the sense that the amount of grants Because again, this the Gladys Berejiklian matter comes back to, effectively gerrymandering grants to act for their own political advancement rather than the integrity of, you know, the evaluation criteria that a department would ordinarily have. That's the whole point. The grant for the Australian Clay Target Association had a benefit cost ratio of below one when it was first investigated by the Department of Planning, Industry and the Environment. And then all of a sudden, she was a chair of the Expenditure Review Committee, recommissioned the thing, and then all of a sudden it had a BCR of above one, so it qualified for the grant, and it was allocated. So all these sort of things where you have holes for these sort of things to take place, they should be eliminated. And that's when I go to, when I talk about the whole of government response, it's the anti-corruption agency is just one part of a broader approach to stamping out corruption and having faith in our public sector and our institutions. But we've had, at the federal level, we've had the sports rot scandal that generated a lot of media attention between the bushfires and the pandemic. That was $100 million worth of, targeted, effectively election funding for their campaign. The car park rorts. Now, if you thought 0.88 was a low benefit cost ratio for the grants, some of these car parks had a 0.03 benefit cost ratio. So effectively, you were getting 3 cents back on the dollar for every dollar investment. You know, and they still passed it through. So, the gas-led recovery dollars to federal donors, the mismanagement of JobKeeper, I think it's $27 billion, the most recent number that's gone to profitable companies in that period of time. And of course, a robo-debt scandal. All these things could potentially be matters for a federal ICAC to investigate and to ultimately hold the public sector at a federal level to a higher standard than what it's currently held. Now, I think a lot of people would be behind a federal ICAC. I saw in the Sydney Morning Herald on the weekend in their poll that 88% of people would love to see a New South Wales-like model for ICAC. Now, ironically, Scott Morrison's argument was that the very outcome for Gladys Berejiklian and her resignation just because of an announced investigation is a reason why they shouldn't adopt that model. Go figure, hey? I don't think that's the case, but look, we need to have an anti-corruption commission. I think the vast majority of Australians will be on board, as is a little synopsis of that Sydney Morning Herald. I wouldn't expect it to be as high as 88% because of the demographic the Sydney Morning Herald appeals to, but I certainly would expect it to be the vast majority. And it's certainly shaping up to be an election-shaping issue at the next election, because Labor's committed to a federal ICAC, largely based off the New South Wales model. I presume that, the ability to hold public hearings and sweeping powers to uphold the standards of public sector ethics and corruption would be involved too. Because the approach to corruption, right, and it's easy, everyone's got integrity except for when it comes to themselves, right? That's the ultimate test. You know, you can have integrity when you look at another one, you can throw stones, but if you don't have integrity when it comes to yourself, that's why it needs to be independent. So, people could say, Labor's engaging corruption. Of course they have. It's a political process. But the whole point is you have to be strong enough to say, look, this is not good enough. Just because it's been done in the past doesn't mean that it should be going on going forward. And that will be a test for Anthony Albanese and his leadership. He needs to maintain on that, even if it does expose, shine light in dark places, that involve branch stacking or political donations, And again, as I said before, small part of a bigger net. The anti-corruption agency is one part, but, what about private donations and disclosure of that towards federal parliament. All these things are in mesh together as a web of activities that you could participate in. So, I think that's a good place to leave it. Joe, any final thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, just in terms of the federal ICAC, I guess if you're a politician who says you care about the future of Australia but you're too scared of the immediate implications of a corruption body, then you're not caring about the future, because the more people who go down for it now, the more people who get exposed now, just means less people will do it in the future, ideally. I'm all for it.
For sure. That's a great place to finish. Let us know your thoughts on that. That was quite a wide-reaching discussion, but I love engaging on this matter, and I think we covered it pretty well. But now we'll move on to some something that we even know more about, and that is a bit of rugby league.
Something I say I know more about.
Something we know more about watching than we do about playing, that's for sure. as they would say, Roy and HG would say, happy rugby league. In the great words of Peter Volandi's AO. Now, we're going to go through two key aspects here. Number one, let's do a grand final review. Now, it's personally my most favourite grand final since 2015. That was the Broncos-Cowboys Golden Point Thriller. We saw, for those of you who don't know, the Penrith Panthers defeated the South Sydney Rabbitohs 14 points to 12. Effectively came down to a missed conversion from the sideline from Adam Reynolds. Not much could separate the two teams. And it was an epic defensive battle, sprinkled with moments of brilliance from the likes of Nathan Cleary, Cody Walker, Stephen Crichton, Critter, the man from the 2770. Your reflections on the grand final. Did you see it shaping up like this?
I genuinely thought it was going to be a pretty high-scoring battle, honestly. It's just with South's attack and, you know, like, Penrith love to stick with teams. So I thought it was going to be up, like, both teams over 20 easy. But, yeah, I was shocked. I mean, Penrith playing three of the hardest games any team would ever have to play in their life. That, you know, what was it, 8-6 against Parramatta, then 10-8 or something against Melbourne, or 12-8
yeah,
or something
6, against 10-6, Melbourne.
10-6 against Melbourne, and then you go in 14-12 against the Rabbits. Like, you got to give it to them. Like, they are the premiers after that. You can't show three games like that and then question if they're the right one for the top spot. But yeah, I was blown away by South. I think the way they turned their season around towards the back end of the year and came out and gave that performance and had to put themselves in a genuine position to win. I mean, I know the game got blown off one terrible error by Cody Walker, but, you know, one slip up for in the last 6 weeks, flawless 6 weeks of your career. So,
and obviously he's got that for trying that individual try in the first half.
Yeah, like it does balance out. But I mean, you know, he'd probably rather not have scored a grand final try, you know, if he didn't throw the intercept. Like that intercept would haunt you forever.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the best play Stephen Crichton will probably ever make in his career. And I'm sure he's okay with that.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
And I think it goes back to the age-old adage that defence wins premierships.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
Penrith just put up a steel wall. Mm. They effectively, they were the Blue Mountains, you know, and no one could get over the top of it, you know. You know, they tried, but, you know, unfortunately, you know, it was just having that trust. I mean, some of their scramble defence in that prelim against Melbourne was insane. The amount of times where the ball got about an inch off the ground and, you know, Melbourne were, you know, a moment away from sealing it. Someone came underneath to hold them up, and you know, it was just a sensational defensive resolve. And you know, obviously a lot of them were bruised and battered. Dill Edwards had a broken foot, I believe, and he played on a broken foot for the best part of 5-6 weeks throughout the last part of the regular season and into the final series.
Cleary just had a shoulder injury yesterday.
Busted shoulder, and you know, obviously he had that AC joint, I think, issue just after Origin, and then he went out for, you know, 4 weeks to have a, you know, rest and rehabilitated, but obviously he couldn't have surgery because that was season ending, and he just had to sort of negotiate the pain.
Hey, well, he knew what was on the table. And, yeah. I mean, he got there. Like,
and his kicking game, he just kicked them almost into oblivion.
He's just incredible. Yeah. Like he's something that blows me away the most is just his ability to perform on a big stage.
Yeah.
He saw it. He led New South Wales to you know, one of our, like, few Origin wins in the last few years, steps up, loses a grand final next year, pulls his team back the whole way through, gets wins it this year. Like, he's, for such a young bloke, he's just, like, his leadership talent on the big stage is just, like, it's incredible. And I think he's going to be in like that. If you're like that at that stage of your career, he's going to be around for 10, 15 years.
Yeah, and he's only our age as well. Exactly. He's 23, 24, so
grasshopper.
Exactly, and I just think what I like about Nathan Cleary's game, he just knows his game so well. And I mean, that sounds like something Braith and Astor would say, but what I mean by
that
is,
listening, Braith.
Yeah,
you know where my DMs are.
Good luck selling houses with that lemon spread, you Derek. So when I say that, like, he doesn't overplay his hand, like. You know, as a halfback, you'll have 60, 70 touches a game, you know? And six out of those seven touches, just might be structured plays where he drops someone underneath or he gives early ball to his outside back. But that seventh touch, you know, is when he'll pull the trigger on a move, you know, whether it's faking the unders and then creating a 3-on-2 on the outside or you know, putting up one of those torpedo bombs that, you know, that, you know, that bloody Rayman couldn't catch.
Well, he does his homework too. He sticks to his assignment the whole in kicking game, you know what I mean? Like his kicking game, it's pinpoint. It's to a he picks a specific player to kick to every week, and I think that's something like.
And how many repeat sets did he generate in that in a grand final?
That's the thing. That's the thing that separates someone a half of his caliber to another half who's just not there yet with the kicking game. You know what I mean? Like
that's one of the criticisms of actually of people bringing of Luke Brooks is you know his ability to generate repeat sets and. And his kicking game, you know, because his running game is probably, you know, a strong attribute of his game, but that kicking game, it just, you can exert so much control over, you know, the great, great halfbacks have done it. Ricky Stewart, you know, used to kick teams in the oblivion in the late 80s, early 90s.
Because there's just so much, Joey Johns. So much more to it than just kicking the ball away on the tackle and even just kicking it deep. Like, there's more to it. It's like, which side of the field, the forward's more fit? Who's going to get back on like, you know, to run the ball quicker? Who's tired? If you see a forward like in the middle of the field, like you kick in his direction because it's going to take him long to get back. There's so many things that go into a kicking game that I feel like Cleary's just so far ahead in the field. There's a lot of good kickers in the NRL, don't get me wrong, but I just don't think there's anyone on his level at the moment.
Yeah, I think so as well. And I would say Cleary, Tedesco and Trbojevic, hands down, the three best players in the game.
Mate, Turbo is...
And I would say this is probably a stark difference, you know. And if we just use this point of leverage to move on to a discussion to the league and how we see the off-season shaping up and who's going to be contenders and pretenders in 2022. And I think, you know, there's a big difference between the top four teams, top five, six teams and the rest of the competition and how do those other teams narrow the gap is. I just find it's much harder for those other teams down the bottom, say the Dragons, the Tigers, the Bulldogs. The Bulldogs are recruited quite well, but I know you've got your reservations about that. Even the Broncos and the Cowboys is... I just see such a stark difference. If you look at the total amount of players in the competition, those top 10 players in the competition, so I'm talking about Cleary, talking about Tommy Turbo, I'm talking about Tedesco, I'm talking about Isaiah Yeo, Payne, you know, I suppose Payne Haas is a relatively struggling club, but and other, I suppose, Ponga as well. You know, these top 10 players, I just feel like there's such a stark difference. And they, because of the rule changes, they have such an impact on the team. I mean, you look at Tommy Turbo, Manly are cellar dwellers without him.
They were dead in the water.
They were, you know, they were like 0-4 or whatever.
They were written off after three or four games at the start of the year.
And he comes back and they win, you know, 16 in the next 20. You know, and he's just having three tries, just a game, couple of tries. You know, and he's just lighting teams up like you wouldn't believe in. Whereas I feel like probably in the 2000s and 90s, you had those star players, but there was also such a good core of middle players. You could really build a roster and a really good core middle players. And Parramatta is probably in that predicament at the moment, right? Mm. You're just missing a superstar player, so to speak, or that top echelon player. You've got a lot of really good players, you know, Mitch Moses, absolutely. Nathan Brown, Reid Marnie, Clint Gutherson, all these guys are, you know, above average to really good football players. But you know, even then, it's hard for them to crack because you don't have, Pappenhausen.
That's true, but I guess at the end of like when we think about it, the most successful team model we've seen is the Melbourne Storm. And when I say team model, I mean not needing that star player and the kind of next man up mentality. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't matter what position you're playing. It's you're coming into a system, you're coming into a team situation, whereas that's not what Manly relied on for their success this year. So it's not out of question to be that sort of team platform rather than relying on a star player, but that takes years and years and years of building and the right people, you know what I mean? So yeah, you got to get super lucky to land one of the, you know, have like land one of those generational type talents, but that's where I think it comes into enriching the game further because that you put more effort into your juniors and I feel like that if there was more attention on junior football and like younger ages coming up, I feel like all teams would be stronger. All teams would have more star caliber players. Like you just look at the American system, the amount of effort that goes into the younger ages, the high schoolers coming into college, those guys are already superstars before they're in the NBA. You've got NBAs or NFL players who have their eyes on kids in year eight, you know what I mean? And I feel like if that attention came to the NRL, if that sort of momentum can be brought onto players at a young age, you're going to see more of these guys, and it's just going to make it better for the fans too. It's just going to give us more to talk about. The league will be able to expand more. We'll have a bigger, more national game that'll be better off for everyone. So I think those guys, those Turbos, those Clearys, they're leading the way for this to happen.
For sure.
It's good.
And that brings me, because the point I was trying to get to there is, I suppose, again, I look at everything through a lens of a West Tigers lens, a decade of mediocrity, as some people would say, of no finals. But people are always looking for, we've been caught in the trap before of looking for a quick fix. You know, like especially when we lost Tedesco, Moses and Woods, all local juniors, all rep players, was that we went for a quick fix to try and get on the market. But my point that I'm trying to get to is, you have to go the organic build. That has to be the model for a club like the West Tigers. I mean, you could talk about the Storm, who have a crux of players, and then they buy fringe players around who excel in the Melbourne Storm system. But let's not forget that Melbourne Storm arrived at this position through a competitive advantage they gained through a salary cap rorting scandal. Absolutely. So it's like, Robin Peter to pay Paul. Whereas the Panthers, Gus's 5-year plan didn't quite turn out to be 5 years, but about 11 years. But that's neither here nor there. All those players grew up together. And you could tell when they play together, they're representing the area. Jerome Luai, Bizar, Brian Tottle, Stephen Crichton, these guys, they love playing for the area. Even like guys like Isaiah Yeo and Matt Burton, who are from Country New South Wales, Dubbo, they identified their pathway systems through the Country Rugby League. And that
is big, but I don't think that is a thing that all clubs can
do. Of course not. But clubs like Penrith, Parramatta, West Tigers, St George, where you have a strong heartland, even South Sydney, a strong heartland, a strong junior league that feeds into quite a strong, junior representative system. That's the approach that you like to go. Even Newcastle, Newcastle's got a strong history of bringing through players. And you got, Queensland teams as well. Obviously the Brisbane Broncos there were nearly, a powerhouse for two decades because, they had the entire, Brisbane catchment coming through. But, you've got North Queensland as well. It's a rugby league nursery as well. So, obviously some clubs like the Roosters and the Gold Coast has got, got quite a good pedigree as well. Perhaps Canberra, they'll have to look for that sort of procurement model where you bring people in.
You got to find that sort of thing to strike at the passion of the players in your local area. Because I know like those Penrith boys, they play for each other and they play for the area, yes, but they're more playing for the people in the area, what I mean? The people they grew up with, the people who went through the same either struggles or successes that they did, They're representing more the people than the actual area, which are like one in itself, right? So not every club and not every local area is going to have that same sort of sentiment.
I love that.
But I guess the club needs to do their research on their area, needs to do their research on the local population and find what's going to, like bring your team the momentum it needs, like Penrith have done perfectly.
And I suppose if we can just look at the West Tigers, obviously a lot of West Tigers fans who listen as well as me being a diehard Tigers fan is that people say that, they lacked identity, we've got a couple of hungers, we play at Bank West, we play, at Leichhardt, we play at Campbelltown, but we should be utilising that junior base and that Group 6 area from like in that southwestern corridor, Camden, Campbelltown, produce like the likes of James Tedesco, Chrissy Lawrence, and the likes. And then you've also got the Balmain Ride East Network that's produced Luke Brooks, Curtis Surinan, Simon Dwyer, Moses, these sort of players. So the junior network is there, but I just feel like perhaps the professionalisation, I feel like Madge has brought a lot of players into this roster as compared to sort of building it organically, just because I suppose the legacy of Ivan Cleary and, trying to get the quick fix. But when I watched that riveting documentary, Tiger Town, Tales from Tiger Town, Madge would give those passionate displays, and you'd be seeing starry eyes from the players. And I want to see that identity, that ticker, because of what it means to represent people from, Westside. Obviously, I don't got my family tree here, but my great grandfather played for West in the 20s, and then Mum's cousin Paddy Hundy played with Tommy Radonikis in the 70s, And it was, you know, because I suppose all a sort of working class background, you know, this is who you represent. You represented the Fibro houses, you know, for, you know, from Ashfield all the way out west, you know, so in that southwestern corridor, you know, and eventually they moved to Campbelltown, I think in the 80s, when that move took place. But that's who you're representing. Like, do they understand? Like, that's what, you know, and I feel like having that greater purpose itself, you feel it with the Penrith players, you know. Like, they might be exhausted, but they turn up there, whereas, you know, Tigers players, oh, it gets a bit hard, and all of a sudden the momentum's turned against us and the floodgates open, you know. I don't know how many times this season we conceded back-to-back tries, you know, after we conceded one, we conceded another one, you know. And talk about that resilience, you know. I know it's hard, you know, like, professional rugby league, you know, there's 8 teams that can make the finals and 8 teams that not. You know, not many other settings do you get that where you have, you know, excellence, you know, you're competing for such a limited number of places. But I suppose for me, like, it's less criticism of the individual player and more so the collective. I mean, defence is an attitude, you know. I often say to people, you know, we'll say, oh, we need this player, we need this player, but until we fix up our defence, you know, we've conceded like under 20 points maybe half a dozen times over the last 2 seasons. You know, you're not winning many football games when you do that, right? You know,
there's a lot of justifying going on here.
Yeah. And what I'm trying to contrast is that Penrith, they were a war, you know?
Yeah,
And they have their star players, but they also have role players. Momorowski, you know, Charlie Stones.
Tyrone May.
Matt Eisenhuth, you know,
Matty role. Burton, dude. He came on, like, you know what I mean? He was a replacement early in the season for injuries, and he came on, ended up being one of their key players to win him a premiership.
For sure. Now, in relation to the 22, let's look at Crystal Baller. You don't know your Nostradamus, and then we came true in relation to South Sydney.
Mate.
Now, I wrote him, for those of you that haven't tuned in recently, I wrote him off about halfway into the season or the start of the season when they got dusted by 50.
I never wrote them off because I wanted to be like, If that happened, I'd be mind blown. And they're getting their way to the finals. I'm like, oh yeah, like they're coming.
They've been winning 8 or 9 in a row as well.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, coming strong. It's to be good. And I'm like, damn, they're not gonna win the finals. No way. They beat Penrith in the. Hang on. Then they come up, pump Manly. I'm like, nah. You kidding? You joking? Get to the grand final. I'm thinking, could this be? Could this be my Nostradamus? Am I really Nostradamus? And they didn't do it for me. But I wanted Penrith to win.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I mean, like even for me, I didn't feel like South really lost, you know what I mean? Because they still played well. It wasn't like they were blowing out. Like, they just had to be a loser on the night, and it happened to be South. Adam Reynolds missed a conversion that he would ordinarily, you know, pot. You know, they scored 2 tries in the run of play, whereas, you know, Penrith, obviously their first try was a defensive area from Campbell Graham, but the second was an intercept completely against the run of play, you know, when South were attacking that left side, which was quite fruitful for them. So I mean,
and if that pass lands, that's a thing. Like yeah, we stop at the intercept, but if that pass lands, was it Alex Johnson? Alex Johnson on that side, he's gone. And that could be what won South the premiership, because they were looking good at, like, they had the overlap. It's just Critter's just an athletic machine.
Yeah, and instead of Danganang saying goodbye to what's his name, Alex Johnson, he was saying goodbye to Stephen Critter Crichton. I'm not sure if the footage went around for the Triple M footage. I had to get
the name on Triple M.
He was on Triple M calling.
Yeah, well, I would have loved a goodbye.
And he was
standing. Instead, all I got was. No respect.
Rabs.
He's a legend.
He just struggles to see, but
he's just like 25 minutes after he took the intercept. Oh, Crichton's got there.
And Crichton's going to run away.
Oh, he scored. It's like, yes, mate. Bloody Cleary's already taken the conversion. Relax.
Like,
come on.
And so I remember his call of Tedesco's trying that origin, you know, when he won it in the 79th minute. Oh, and the ball's gone away. Who is it? Oh, it's James Tedesco. but, you know, he's been a legend for a long time, but perhaps it is time to enjoy yourself.
He's one of Australia's most iconic, like, sports figures, but, come on.
But in the, because you know how that, you know, when, like, they do a radio call and they have the camera in there as well, so you can see them, you know, speaking. they had that for Ghanaian, and he's standing up, he's pacing.
Yeah, see? He's pacing. That's what we need.
Which was excellent. Big Del, Mark Guy was in there as well, obviously, at Penrith. Legend League's part of 91. You know, he was pacing about as well, so he was very happy about that. But yeah, looking at 2022, who do you see? Do you see any teams elevating themselves into the top eight? I mean, and who do you see dropping out? I mean, you probably got Storm, Panthers, Rabbitohs, Seagulls, Roosters, probably, and Eagles. Probably, you'd say they're a good chance of making it again. But then you got Knights, Titans, Sharks, Raiders, Dragons, Warriors. Do we see the Broncos improving? Cowboys. What do you think of the Bulldogs? And we've already talked about the Tigers, so we don't talk about them again. But yeah, who do you see moving up?
Based on what we saw this year, so as you said, I think Storm, Penrith, Rabbitohs, Eagles, Roosters, and Eels. I definitely think we'll see them in the finals. I don't think Eagles will knock in that top four spot again, but I think we'll definitely see them in finals footy. I think the team with the most pressure on them right now, because as we saw, Penrith got beaten in that first round of the finals. So it, for me, some of the calibre of those teams up there doesn't really matter if you're not in the top four. Like, Penrith proved that, even though they were, but you know what I mean. Yeah. They went the long way. I think the team with the most pressure on them is this coming season is the Knights. They've had a couple of years where they've come in with a good team, a good set of players on them, and they're just disappointing. They can't break through. They can't win those hard games. They can't have those battles through the middle and finish on top. So I think with the roster that the Knights have right now and coming into next year, I think they have the most pressure on them to do well. So I like to give them the benefit of the doubt. I think they'll be in the top eight. So there's seven out of the eight teams that made it this year. Then the fight for that last spot, you've got a lot of, everyone's getting all up and down about the Bulldogs, and yeah, that's great, but I don't think straight away, nah. You know what I mean? Like, new players on a whole team. I was talking about someone about this the other day.
They're going to have so many players.
You bring in all the new players. That's great. But sometimes it takes a team with great players 3 or 4 years to gel. Yeah. So, Bulldogs, yeah, I'll give them a couple of years and they'll be good. People getting up and down about the Sharks too. They're going to be a great team. I think...
Nico Hines, Dale Finucane.
I think the Sharks, maybe next year. I think the year after that 2024 season, that 2023 season, I genuinely think Sharks will be like up. They'll be up. They'll be fighting for a top four spot.
The question is...
I still think that number, that eighth position is still so open to the same teams it was this year.
And Nico Hines and Dale Finucane, there's obviously the curse in relation to, they talk about people leaving the Melbourne Storm system and not being as effective as people like Adam Blair and other players that have left, and perhaps not being, you know, Kevin Proctor is another one. Tohu Harris still does a job for the Warriors, but perhaps doesn't get as much notoriety as he did as a Storm, because I suppose the more successful team. But can Nico Hines, who I know Harry Tate thinks will be a bust at the Sharks because he's not in the Melbourne system.
Oh, I do too.
So there you go. And then Finucane's obviously probably a bit less of an issue because he just does a role.
I still think Finucane will be a New South Wales back row.
But one of the shining lights for the Sharks, I think over the last two seasons, has been the unveiling of Bubba Kennedy. He's probably one of my favourite players in the competition. He doesn't get enough notoriety. And I say him and Dane Laurie are probably my two favourite sort of up-and-coming fullbacks in the game. Both of Indigenous background. It is the excitement when they play. They're great with 3-on-2s. They're, you know, good runners of the ball. They're reliable under the high ball. You know, so I think that's good. People like Connor Tracy as well. There's Luke Metcalf as well. He's he tore the Tigers up. I'm not saying that's too hard of a job these days, but you know, he's a half coming through. I'm not sure how much Matt Moylan's got left in his system.
I don't like his future at the Sharkies with all the talent coming through there.
The Raiders, I just see him stagnating.
I was talking to the old man about the Raiders today, and he's a passionate Raiders fan. He obviously is panic buttons. But, you know, they've signed Fogarty, I think, which will help them. I mean, in terms of who's available in the halves market, like, you don't have many options right now, especially with the new, obviously, the Dolphins coming through. Like, they're going to need two premiership-worthy halves to compete. So there's not much going around in terms of halves available. So I think locking up Fogarty for the Raiders will do them a big boost. But I think they've still got some struggles internally that they got to work out. I mean, they've gone from being a grand final contending team and to not even making the finals in just 2 years. So I think they've got a lot to work out, but I definitely think they can still push into that top eight if everything goes right for them. But yeah, I just think that eighth position is the most up for grabs between the teams that were going for it this year. Titans, that was my other Nostradamus, said Titans wouldn't make the finals. They were very close to not making the finals.
They were 10-14.
They were very close. They shouldn't have made the finals.
They really should have been probably the Sharks. I mean, that just goes to show. I mean, look at that. I mean, you haven't seen that in much in years gone by where teams with a losing record have made the finals. I mean, the basic stat has been you need 12 wins.
Yeah.
The Knights obviously got 12 and 12, but I think it just goes to show
look at that disparity.
Look there. I think it's just sort of the gap between the powerful clubs at the top and then the bottom. There's a lot of losses that go into these wins up here. You know, it's Storm 21-3, Panthers 21-3, Rabbitohs 20-4. You know, even then mid tier teams like the Seagulls, Roosters, Eels. You know, 2 wins for every 1 loss. And then you go into here, it's the other story. You know, for the Dragons, the Warriors, the Tigers, the Broncos, and then even worse for the Dogs and the Cowboys down the bottom. And if we're talking about the Dragons, I know we have a couple of Dragons friends. Obviously, one of my close friends from school is a Dragons fan. And Huey Money Morgan loves to talk about the Dragons and, loves to talk about the pedigree of Ben Hunt and the boys down there and the Gong. I think they've got Moses Sully coming on board. Jaden Sewer's coming on board. Paul Vaughan's obviously out the door going to the Dogs. Matt Dufty's out the way to the Dogs. So, I mean, I don't really see any great improvement with those players coming on board. I mean, sure, Sully plays a role, but, you know, like, how much is it outside playing outside Turbo?
Not going to come and dictate terms by any means.
No, he's a centre. So, you know, again, Moses Mbai as well, you know, like, he's, you know, he's a solid player, but is he going to make that much of a difference to your roster?
Warriors get the spoon next year.
You reckon?
That's my notion.
I just feel like the Warriors can always find wins somewhere along the way.
This is my biggest fear for the Warriors is when they go back to New Zealand, nobody cares. Nobody cares. And they will, that's the thing, they will care. They will care if the Warriors are playing good footy and they're winning. But if they don't, if they won't win games, people in New Zealand have every right not to care. They go, all right, we'll focus on you.
Yeah.
All right, we don't care. That's fine. No one, New Zealand, when the Warriors go back to New Zealand, they're dead. I think the best thing that could have happened to them was their time. Obviously, the players would have been in a real hard situation, missing their families and stuff, and you can't, you know what I mean? Like, you can't compare with that with anything else. That the most important thing is them being close to their families and being happy, which is why being in New Zealand is a good thing for them. But for the club, they played unreal footy. They were drawing so much attention. Everyone wants to jump on board and help them out. People loaning them players. Now you've got like people stepping on board to help the executive out. Like, that was amazing for the club. People wanted to watch the Warriors play, but they go back to New Zealand, nobody's going to care. Nobody's going to want to help them out. Nobody's going to want to go and play there, and they get the spoon next year.
Yep.
Because Dogs got the spoon this year with 3 wins, with a pathetic 3 wins. And they're bringing some great players into the club next year. I don't think they're going to make the finals, but they're not going to get 3 wins. Okay, yeah. So Warriors, one more loss away from them tying with people who came 15th, 14th and 13th. So you go, I think the factor of going back to New Zealand for them will put them on the bottom of the ladder.
And I think there will be some improvement in the Dogs. Let's hope so. You can't get much worse than 3-21. But the Broncos as well, got Benny Larkin on board as the director of football up there. I think they made a very smart signing in Adam Reynolds.
Mm.
He'll be a big loss for South.
Yeah.
And a big signing for the Broncos. They need some direction in the halves. And having a quality, experienced halfback cannot be underrated, especially, I suppose, in the halves market that exists today, where there's a real gap between, you know, the top halves and the rest of the competition and what they offer to teams. In terms of a fearless prediction for the Broncos, I think Selwyn Cobbo is probably one of the most exciting prospects coming through. I know I mentioned this to the boys the other day when we were talking about it after the Queensland Cup final, but he reminds me of Latrell. He's like a Latrell, troll. So, Max, that's He's just a Megatron, if you want to call him that.
Massive.
I feel like he's got even a bit more toe than Latrell, a bit more nippy, but he's still got that, you know, he's still tall.
Nippy?
Yeah, a bit of nip. Got a bit of range in him. And do you see, I saw him they put up a towering bomb, he was under pressure, and he took it and came out the other side and stepped a few guys around 70 metres. I mean, it's a special talent. It was like, I feel like it's a bit of a, a curse, when you compare these guys to Greg Inglis and Latrell, but
he's got flashes for sure.
He's got the runs on the board, and I think he'll make the Broncos fullback position his own, because who's got the... Yeah, so Selwyn Cobbo is my player of the to look forward to in 2022, but I believe you've also got a player, and you're looking in your own backyard for this one.
I am, mate, and we haven't talked about Parra enough, and I'll have a word to you about it after we go off the air, mate. Don't worry about that. But I really liked what I saw from Will Penasini at the end of the year. Through finals. Yeah, I just think he's going to make a massive difference to that team, especially with some of our struggles defending out wide. I think he's a good young player, and I think, he's got a lot of room for development. But he just showed me some great things at the end of the year, good try-scoring ability. He's tough. I don't think I have to remind anyone about that fend he put on Matt Burton in the semi, because I watch that on repeat every single
day. The Grim Reaper!
Absolutely buried him. But, I'm really excited to see what Penasini's going to do next year, and he's my player who I'm keeping an eye on.
Fantastic. And that's one for Joel Schiffler, if you're listening. And Harry Tate, we do actually take consideration of the up-and-coming players, because no one knows the market like us two hosting the podcast. But that's neither here nor there. Just quickly, the Redcliffe Dolphins, their bid has been successful to come into the NRL now. They won't be called the Redcliffe Dolphins. They'll be some sort of dolphin, whether that's the Sunshine State Dolphins. It's mentioned with sort of the Golden State Warriors vibe or North Brisbane. They're capturing that whole northern corridor. They've got the infrastructure in place, 15,000-seat stadium, a leagues club that you can watch the football for at the end of the ground, like a spa and health facility as well. So the financials have been sound, and I think that's what the NRL is looking for. But as you well know, but some of our listeners may not, Wayne Bennett has signed on, the world's worst-kept secret, that he was signing on for 2023 to be their head coach for 3 years. So you've got an open salary cap with one of the game's greatest coaches. I want you to put yourself in his shoes for a minute and tell me who you're going to sign, maybe two or three players, and then what your overall strategy will be.
As you were saying, massive signing with Wayne Bennett. I think that's a perfect place to start. Going for that Queenslander option. He's going to draw those fans in immediately. And we were talking about this the other day, Paul. The Redcliffe they have an existing fan base. They're an old club. So that's going to be huge for them. But I think they need to continue on that run. I think they need to sign some more young marquee Queenslander players. My first thought that goes to Harry Grant. The other day we were also talking about Munster as well, which would be absolutely huge. And I think they've got to take that opportunity to draw in the Queenslander interest with Queenslander players. And not saying that it has to be a strictly Queensland team, just saying that those first big signings that they announced will go a long way if they're, Queensland origin representative type level players. I think that'd be huge for the club. And huge for the NRL as well, obviously, for future expansion. Because if this goes right, it'd encourage a whole lot of other clubs to do the same thing. And that's what I'd love to see. I'd love to love the NRL to be a 20-team league, like eventually. So I think I'm really excited for the Dolphins to come through. And I think they can get it right. And I think it's very important for the future of rugby league in this country that they get it right.
Fantastic. And I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I'd probably go with a similar approach. And obviously, we're probably looking forward to a long-term, an 18th team, whether that be an expansion across the Western Frontier to South Australia or WA, or whether you go a bit more of an organic approach, having a Pacifica team, whether that's based in the South Island of New Zealand or somewhere in the Pacific. I think, obviously, we have over 50% of players now are Pacifica background, so... you certainly have the caliber and the talent of player that would be great, and it'd be great to see that sort of turn into a franchise, so to speak, where you'd have the cultural roots as well. So Yeah, I think that's a good place to leave it. I think we've chewed each other's ear off. We didn't realise how long we've been talking there for a while, but it has been a while between potties. Well, it has been a while since we've had been together. Obviously, did Olympics one virtually, so it's been good to have it back in the flesh here as New South Wales bounces back and we return to whatever COVID normal and what that looks like. We'll wait and see. But again, we're not epidemiologists. We're just a couple of humble dribblers from this, from across the country. One of economist and one's another teacher as well. So we're just out there on the front line doing our thing for the economy. But that's neither here nor there. But we'll leave it there. Plenty of questions, but we've gone over time. So unfortunately, thanks to our question people who've sent questions in, Harry Tate. Matt Skinner, long time listener. So thanks very much for that. And yeah, that's it for political football this week. But stay golden and we'll see you next time.
Give us your best dolphin, Lewis.